Welcome back to Minds Matter, a podcast sponsored by the Monash Center for Consciousness and Contemplative Studies. I'm Beth.
And I'm Ava. And on Minds Matter, we explore research from neuroscience to psychology while occasionally talking through our own personal experiences.
And this week on the podcast, I spoke to Dr. Sarab Sankosaray, and he is a postdoc at the University of Newcastle. And we met at a conference in Australia. What we speak about in this episode is his research involving deep brain stimulation. And I'm not sure if everyone will have come across that, but we go through it in the podcast, but it's where you insert an electrode into the brain. So this isn't just recording brain signals from the scalp, you record them from inside the brain. And we speak about how that research can help us understand depression and as well, in certain situations, treat depression. And we also talk about how this technique is involved in a lot of epilepsy treatments and how we can get data from these patients as well.
I started off as a clinician, so I did my medicine in BBS, and I practiced for a couple of years. I was trying to do psychiatry residency while I was already attracted to psychiatry. So I just wanted to pursue more of the research side than the practicing side. So I ended up doing a master's in neuroscience from the University of York, where I learned a lot about fMRI, EEG. My project was with TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation. I think I was a bit greedy trying to get on trying all these new techniques and everything. I think that's where I started to know properly the depths of neuroscience and where it can lead to. And one of the fundamental things was also, if you just practice, maybe you can improve the lives of people one at a time. But maybe you can do some fundamental discoveries, maybe on the umbrella thing, you can just create new therapies, treatments, and so that's one of the motivation. But it's just fascinating neuroscience in general. So I ended up doing my PhD in Brisbane, and there my main motivation was I was already interested in a lot of affective neuroscience, emotional disorders. So one main thing was trying to bridge this brain-body communication. And one reason that I found out that the field of emotion research hasn't really capitalized on is the use of multimodal data. So you can't just study the brain in isolation, but you also need the physiological responses of heart rate, facial expressions, the behavior, and those kind of things. And fortunately, I also got a collaboration in my PhD from my epileptologist at the Mater Hospital in Brisbane. And they were starting to get this stereo imaging, which I think we'll discuss later on, but this intracranial implants. And I thought this was a wonderful opportunity. And that's where my crux of my research direction has come from, mostly this affective neuroscience, emotions, brain-body interaction, interoception. Once I finished my PhD, I went to Cambridge for a postdoc. And that's where some of my research into some of the other protocols of TMS and that. And my boss there, my supervisor there, was really into addiction and research, so some of those research. So it feels like there's a lot of different things, but I think it is tied by this overarching basic emotional domain, because that affects or permeates all the psychological fields and everything. And yeah, and then there are obviously lots of techniques with fMRI and signal processing and everything. Yeah, but I think I'll give you a concise answer. It would be trying to find brain-body interactions and interoception research with multimodal data and use transcranial magnetic stimulation not only as a research tool, but also as a therapeutic.
I actually didn't know you started off in doing a psychiatry residency. That's super interesting. I didn't know that was your part of your journey.
I think that was when I started to realize I'm way more interested in knowing more than practicing.
Yeah.
It's just because there's so much to know and it's all fascinating. I had started to lean towards neuroscience more and more.
So some of your work looks at direct neuronal recordings. I think a lot of our listeners won't have ever heard about that before. So can you explain what that is? And then you also mentioned TMS. Could you also explain that as well? Because I think maybe both of those can sometimes get mixed up. Can you explain both of them?
Absolutely. So I think the historical recording techniques we have had with neuroimaging have been the scalp electroencephalogram, which just gives you recordings from the scalp from the head, and it doesn't give you a very good measure of where exactly the activity is coming from. Although it gives very nice recordings in terms of the time domain, millisecond resolution. And then comes the fMRI, functional MRI, which gives you the coverage of the whole brain. So you know very precisely where the activity is happening. But again, it's a proxy measure of the neuronal activity, and it's a bit slow. So where the intracranial recordings come from historically is just in patients with epilepsy, where either you open the skull and put a grid of electrodes on the top of the brain, and you record from these contact electrodes, or which is called the electrocorticography. And the other thing is the stereo electroencephalography, where you put thin wires which have multiple contacts on them, and through burr holes on the scalp, you can just penetrate deep inside the skull. So you can target a lot more deeper structures in that way. And the idea behind them, or at least the clinicians and the epileptologists, have some hypothesis where the seizures are coming from. So they'll try to target those regions. But obviously, when you are putting these deep electrodes, some of the other parts of the brain are also being recorded, which are not epileptogen. And so you get recordings from that. Typically, in the stereo region, once the patients have these implants, the patient is transferred in a room with wires hanging out from those electrodes into a, and they can stay there for up to 4 days, 5 days, even sometimes 7 days, 8 days, continuous recordings with very high sampling rates, so 1,000 hertz or something, or even more. During that time, the patients can get seizures. And if you have those recording the seizures, you can find out exactly what part of the brain the seizures are coming from. But obviously, the patient is not getting the seizure all the time. It's only 3-4 episodes of seizures, 5 seizures or something. So the rest of the time, you can do some experimental tasks. And you can use this task to find the precise functioning of those specific brain regions. Although you don't get the whole brain coverage, but at least you get good coverage of some of the regions. Usually it's a medial temporal lobe epilepsy, and it has to be focal epilepsy as well. Just I have to mention this, because if this is generalized epilepsy, you can't put electrodes everywhere. But if the epilepsy is focal, which means like it's coming, or at least it's believed to be coming from certain parts of the brain, you can target those parts of the brain. And once the epileptologist analyzes this, finds out that this is, they can have multiple recourse. So you can actually resect that part of the brain if it's not too important, or it might give some seizure freedom. But in either case, you get this time span where you can do some experimental tasks and really precisely map out what the neurons in that specific region are doing in those specific tasks. Most of the time, the recording sites are usually amygdala, hippocampus, insula, cingulate, some regions in prefrontal cortex or parietal cortex, not so much into the visual and the parietal cortex, but still done. So I think it's an excellent measure to want to validate some of the findings in the past, but also just the spatial and temporal precision that you get from these recordings. It's the recordings are so keen that sometimes you can actually see it on a trial-based task, some of the high-frequency activity just in the raw data itself, which anybody who's worked with scalp EEG know how noisy and how much pre-processing that needs.
So how common would this be? I think maybe for listeners, the idea of drilling little holes in the electrodes is, I don't know if many people have heard of this as a procedure before. So how common would this be?
So it wasn't as common back in the day, in the 90s and all, and they've started, these clinics have sprung up a lot. The technology is there because now they do it with a stereotactic frame, so you know exactly how to target. There's a robot that can insert these implants. There are big clinics which have come up, the Cleveland Clinic. France historically has been very at the forefront of this. So these have sprung up a lot in the whole world now. Even in Australia now, I think we have that one in Westmead. In Brisbane, we have at the Mater Hospital. There's another one in Melbourne. And epilepsy is a generally common disorder, and not all people with epilepsy will get this. It's only done in patients who have really severe epilepsy and treatment resistant. So none of the treatments work properly, and they have really bad frequent seizures. So they might get like 5 seizures a day or 9. They won't be able to work properly come dry. So this is reserved for these cases. And because the, like, we think, okay, yes, we are drilling holes or the other one, failure on the opening of the skull. Yes, there are side effects and kind of infections, but I think we have progressed and advanced quite a lot in terms of this technology. So the infection rates have fallen, and more clinics are employing the stereo imaging because it seems to be less invasive than the other one. Yeah, the infection rates seem to be less as well. So it is getting commoner throughout the world.
If you could explain how TMS is different, and then, yeah, how these things relate to, why are they helpful for mental health?
Right. Yeah. So TMS stands for transcranial magnetic stimulation, and it's just a coil, a magnetic coil attached to the device, and it generates these magnetic pulses. And the idea behind it is that we can just give very transient high strength magnetic pulses, and based on the protocol that we use, like how often the pulses come in time or the frequency, you can either excite or inhibit the part of the brain that you are targeting. And I think it, obviously it was a great research tool, but it, I think, has gotten more and more popular because it's been used for therapy as well now. So it's FDA approved for depression. I think it got the approval early 2000s. And what it does exactly, based on the protocol, which is the repetitive TMS protocol, it targets that part of the brain, and you can do all sorts of things. Because the idea is that sometimes you can very temporarily affect that part of the brain and make the participants, the research participants, do a bunch of tasks and see how they perform before and after the TMS is given. So maybe there'll be increase in reaction time, decrease in reaction time for those kind of ones. So as a researcher, it's fantastic. And with more advancement of technology, there have been better coils, so you can target better, more focally. The issue was always you can't, or at least the magnetic field doesn't penetrate very deeply. It follows the inverse square law. So the deeper structures were never targeted properly. They've developed new coils where you can target, or at least the field goes much deeper. So you can target deeper structures like amygdala. And there have been papers which have shown that the functional connectivity changes, or there's some functional connectivity response, in bold response for these regions. So as a tool for research, it's fantastic that you can, if you have proper circuits, it's in the superficial part of the brain, you can causally test it. And I say causally, I do the inverted commas, it's like a virtual lesion, maybe, to say. And as a therapeutic tool as well, it's being used with psychiatric illnesses, depression. There have been trials with OCD, and more it's being taken at the network level so that you can modulate the networks, not just a focal region. And yeah, wonderful research with these things. And then there's the preciseness of, so everybody will have a different kind of a brain. So their spots will be slightly different. So you can target medicine framework where you can quantify the functional connectivity of the people's brain, and what would be the most optimal spot for that person in a therapy or even in research. And that opens up more doors on the precision medicine front.
Awesome. Because once Ava and I were wondering, and I think you just answered this, how can TMS be used in a research setting where it's just, you know, inhibiting one region, but then how then is it different in a therapeutic setting where those effects last more than just the session? Because we were like, because you wouldn't want to do research if it was going to last more than just the session. Yes. But then the same tool seems to be applied in therapy when it, but it's about the networks then, that's the difference.
It has also, yeah, it is the networks, but it's also about the frequency.
Okay.
Sometimes the patients might have to come 4 times a week.
Okay.
They have to do it for a month, and I think the effects last for 6 months or something, and they might have to come back again. There's also been new, what's it called, accelerated paradigm, where you give even 2 doses of this TMS in a day or even more. And that seems to decrease the symptoms way faster than the standard ones. Mm-hmm. So as I was talking about the intracranial EEG, in epilepsy, you put a lot of electrodes to different parts of the brain. With deep brain stimulation, you are targeting only specific parts of the brain. So it started with Parkinson's disease, where you target a specific nuclear, which is called the subthalamic nuclear, very important in the motor movements part of the basal ganglia. And you target that part of the brain, and you put electrodes, and you stimulate the electrode. They have a pacemaker that is also implanted in the chest. And you stimulate the electrode, you get at a very high frequency, so 130 hertz, 160 hertz or something. And that seems to resolve the symptoms of motor movements that you get in Parkinson's disease. And because it was so successful for Parkinson's disease, people tried to use the same logic for psychiatric illnesses. But with Parkinson's, which is a very much neurological disease, so we knew a lot from animal research and there's studies that what specific circuits were disrupted and everything. So we knew exactly where to go for. But with psychiatric illness, that is still a topic of debate. There are multiple targets for psychiatric, and many people advocate various targets. And research is being conducted as we speak. Hopefully, we'll find the optimal target. But I think there can be many targets rather than just one based on the networks.
We were just talking before we started recording about the videos that, if you've ever seen a video of this process happening in your undergrad class, it's always pretty amazing to see someone have it. I've just seen the video where they have a complete change in emotion from the stimulation. So it's a pretty, it's a pretty incredible thing.
Yeah, exactly. Like this, not just the deep brain stimulation, but even with the TMS, like one of those early treatments for some of the psychiatric illnesses, psychosis, or even very severe depression was the electroconvulsive therapy. So you can just consider TMS as a very mild form of this without any side effects, because for the ECT, you always needed an anesthetist to be there and it had a lot of side effects. So this is a very mild version of that with the TMS.
So now we're going to talk about some of your own work. So your 2022 study recorded neural activity in people with treatment-resistant depression. Can you explain what you did and what you found and how this can help us understand why some people don't respond to antidepressants?
Yes, absolutely. So this fits in, this aligns very well because we just discussed basic deep brain stimulation for psychiatric illnesses. So habenula is a small, very small kind of a epithalamic structure, which is just near the midbrain. And it seems to form a link between the prefrontal cortex and the midbrain, main nuclear regions of the midbrain. And it's a very, I would say, phylogenetically conserved structure. So it's present throughout the animals. Obviously, in humans, it has much more nuclei and everything. And it's very hard to find this activation in, or at least the habenular activation in fMRI studies, because it's really small. A lot of animal research, although did focus on it, and they had found some dysfunctions in animal models of depression and things like that. So we had this small clinical trial where the idea was to put these electrodes into this habenula and record the electrical activity. This was the first study when I started my postdoc in Cambridge, and it was a kind of very hypothesis driven because we had a lot of animal literature, and the animal literature suggested that there's a hyperactivity of habenula in depression. So more hyperactivity, more depression severity. And we had this data with these recordings. So just to also mention here that why this hyperactivity of habenula is related to depression is because, as I said, it links the prefrontal and the midbrain regions, but it's also linked to very critically to the production of neurotransmitters in downstream. So I think if the connection is right, there's an excitatory output from habenula to a structure, and then that structure has an inhibitory response to the raphe nucleus, which is the serotonin production centers, and also to dopamine. So depression is always considered as a serotonin deficiency or dopamine deficiency. So the more activity there is in habenula, the greater inhibition it is to produce the serotonin. So more activity leads to less serotonin in the system. And so they had found this in mouse models inhibiting. And we had this recordings from human habenula. So I thought maybe that we can quantify this and see if that is indeed true. And I quantified something called as a aperiodic component of the signal. Most of the time with EEG, any signals, we tend to focus on the rhythmic activity. So very oscillatory activity, alpha, theta, beta. But also these activities are embedded within oscillatory activity, irregular activity. The animal model suggested that there's a lot of bursting activity. This is regular spikes that come on. That's why it is hyperactive. So this aperiodic component, we can quantify this with these new methods that came out to be like 5 years, 6 years ago. And that gives you a measure of how much the irregular activity is. So I quantified that and I just correlated with the depression severity of these patients. And indeed, that's what we found, especially for the left habenula. There's a lot of hemispherical differences there. And we found it for the left habenula that it was the greater the activity, the more the depression it was. So it gives some idea, at least we validate some of the biological animal models. And as I said before, that we don't specifically know which targets would work the best for psychiatric illnesses with this deep brain stimulation. And there's lots of advocated targets. Habenula is one of those targeted regions. The other has been subgenual cingulate, although the clinical trial for that came out to be negative. I think it was like 4 or 5 years back. Then there's others. There's a structure called the bed nucleus of stria terminalis, which can be targeted and is advocated for depression, OCD. There's the ventral capsule. And there are a couple of other regions which have been advocated, but there haven't been large-scale studies on this. So I'm always the case reports or 3-4 subjects. From the recordings, we can then quantify all of these things. Is it the biomarker for depression severity? What's the difference between the anxiety component and the depression component? And coming back to the last bit of your question about why do some people don't respond to the typical antidepressants, it's a very complex, it's probably all psychiatry is embedded in this question, the heterogeneity, the clinical heterogeneity of symptoms, the genetics, some people might tolerate or whatever drugs or medications they give, some might get absorbed better, some might not get absorbed better because of the genetics. And then there's some people might have the serotonin deficiency, some might also have other deficiencies, dopamine. Then there's also the diet factor, the microbiome factor. So it's just, even if you look at the diagnosis or required for depression, it is always, your weight can increase, your weight can decrease. So it's almost the opposite polarity. So it can be anything between them. There can be psychomotor retardation or agitation. So again, so it's just the diagnostic criteria that we have. It's not very objective, and that's the best we've got currently. People will fall into such a big space here in this continuous domain. Not all drugs work, so you always have to go on a trial and error method. Usually you go by what can I not give. So these are the ones that I will eliminate, and I'll start with something that if in a month the there's no improvement, then you move on to the other. And obviously, you also do psychotherapy on those things. It's a varied response. And I think that heterogeneity is encompassed in these symptoms on the brain, on the body workings. And I think that's why we need better objective markers.
I also have a question here about how that ketamine seems to target habenula overactivity. If you want to speak a bit about that, I was just wondering also if you could just sum up this study by... So all this stuff is so interesting, but I think people will listen to this and be like, when can I go and get it? When do you see this stuff being more in mainstream medicine? Or you go to the doctor and they suggest it.
So I speak a bit about ketamine, but I'm not the expert on this. The few things that I do know is ketamine seems to suppress this bursting behavior of the habenula that I was talking about. So any irregular activity that was creating the spikes, extra spikes of activity, it inhibits them. And it does through a lot of pathways. And the effect is very immediate, apparently, as far as my knowledge of the mouse models and how the ketamine is acting. But obviously, there will be different mechanisms on, and that's why it's one of the contenders for treatment, that drug. The other part of your question, like when can people think that they can get this kind of deep brain stimulation treatments? One, it is reserved for very severe ones, severe cases, that is to be considered. Most people are not very comfortable with putting an electrode in the brain, and then you just have to carry, like you just have it. You replace the battery maybe 5-10 years. So you constantly stimulate. And people are not, although it gives, for Parkinson's, it has given like wonderful results. But if you are to ask a person who's suffering from these kind of illnesses, and if you suggest them that, would you prefer a lesion? Like you can just like lesion that out permanently and you don't have to go on with having these electrodes. I think they tend to prefer that. But obviously, that lesioning technique has its own, maybe some side effects, etc. Like it's permanent. whereas this one is not permanent at all. So that comes into play. But also with TM, as I was saying, that is getting picked on more prominently now for treatments. Earlier, that wasn't the case. It's getting picked up more prominently, and especially with the specific protocols and everything, there are better remission rates and everything. Also, there is something called focal ultrasound. So it gives you the precision of a deep brain stimulation, apparently. It's supposed to be the next big thing. And it from the papers and everything, it seems fantastic. So I think we will get there even non-invasively. So we just have to wait out another 5, 10, 15 years.
Yeah, it's exciting because it's very hopeful. I love hearing about this research and that it's just going to keep improving and getting better. So now we're going to go to your 2023 study where you used an intracranial EEG data set. Can you explain a bit about what the aim of this study was?
This is the insular and the singular. Yeah. So I think when I said that in the premise that I'm more interested in the emotion and the comprehensive investigation with not just the brain, but also the physiology, like the body responses and the behavior. I think this paper kind of tackles that, where we wanted to investigate brain-body interaction. And because we had access to these recordings, intracranial recordings, we were specifically interested in something called as the salience network, which consists of the insula and the anterior cingulate. Now, these two regions are quite important in the brain-body interaction, emotions, like even feeling of self. And insula is the hidden part of the brain, by the way. It's considered the fifth lobe of the brain. So you just pull the temporal lobe and look at the part, and inside there is the nasal insula. Neuroanatomically, why this is important is because we have the longest connection of neurons between the anterior insula and the anterior cingulate, which is called the van economo neurons. It's only be found in higher animals. So apparently elephants and whales and chimps and us. It's not as common in other animals, or at least it's not been found, I think. So these two regions anchor the salience network. And salience network is just like anything important, anything arousing, exciting information that is needed, not just from the outside, from the internal body as well. So that comes out as a network in the fMRI studies. And because we had these recordings from these regions, we're like, okay, we can tackle and try to link those brain and body interaction between these two regions. We used some movie stimuli in this. I think that goes into another segue of why we use movies and everything. But I tend to use a lot of movies because that presents really nicely the emotion fluctuations. So the idea was just to try to find the connectivity between these regions and link it to the heart rate. Then we use some computational modeling, and because the movie is quite long, you segment the data into 1 second epochs, 1 second windows. You undertake some computational models. Here, it's what we undertook was dynamic causal modeling. And one of the advantages is that the modeling is based on some biophysical mechanisms. So even the neural cells, the neurons that are present in the gray matter, they are arranged very specifically. So they're superficial neurons, pyramidal neurons, they have deep pyramidal neurons, these telid cells. And there's an intrinsic connectivity between them, which gives to recording activity that we see. And this dynamic causal modeling is just trying to emulate that, basically. Just try to generate a framework of how this activity is produced. So we use that in a moment-to-moment manner and try to link all these properties of how the heart rate changed and also a lot of properties from the stimuli. And we did find that the insula to cingulate connectivity was very much correlated to the heart rate. The cingulate to insula connectivity was a lot more than movie properties, so external stimuli. So these two kind of regions work together to bring about like a coherent experience of the external world and the internal body. Like you can imagine, if I'm happy, but I don't get the physiological responses or the right kind of physiological responses, you might not feel that emotion. Like you might, there's a disconnect there. So these two regions are very central to this kind of work, the brain-body interaction.
And how can this kind of understanding of the brain-body connection, how can that help? Can that help inform us with mental health, especially when things happen, if, for example, with anxiety, where that can be lots going on there. How can that help? Yeah,
so I think you've spoken really things close to my heart here. Because as I said initially when we started talking, this brain-body connection, the comprehensive understanding, getting an integrated framework, which is brain in the body. That's how we understand the world. And although we can study the brain in isolation, but there's so much more information, the intrinsic rhythms of their body that come to the brain. And then the brain, again, modulates it and then comes back. So there's a lot of feedback loops there. And if you mentioned anxiety, those are the kind of illnesses where the physical symptoms are actually in the body, the high heart rate, the sweating. And you can just think of it as feedback loop gone wrong. You already got a trigger, your heart rate starts rising, you start sweating. And this information, in a general sense, the brain will try to minimize these or stop this. But in an anxiety attack or something, the brain might not be able to stop. And it just keeps on increasing, keeps on increasing. So these symptoms are very much prominently seen in these illnesses. And that's why this, I think we should have a comprehensive understanding in an integrated manner of how the body is linked in the brain. The historical theories of emotion itself, they started with the physiological reactions. William James and all, they said that actually the emotions come from the different patterns of the physiological responses. And then there was corrections, updates to all of this. And now we consider it's a mix of both the bringing or praising the body signals with the context and everything. But then this is what I'm trying to stress, is that the body is quite important in generating those feelings, the emotions and everything. And we still haven't fully leveraged or really taken advantage of this multimodal data sets. Because even in fMRI, we tend not to regress it out. We regress the heart rate and the other things out. But that is still quite important in terms of, and I think there are lots of researchers who are doing all of these things. And I think if we can then come up with better measures, and even from the basic understanding, we know how that is disrupted, and then we can target those kind of things with stimulation or therapies.
So, Ava, I first learned about this deep brain stimulation in undergrad. I can't remember what course it was, but some undergrad neuro course, where I was wondering if you had seen this video or if anyone else listening has seen this video. I tried to get a copy of it online, but I couldn't. So it must be you have to have some access to it. But it's a woman, she's awake and she's getting the electrodes implanted and she has terrible depression. This is going off my memory of something that I watched 8 years ago, but I have a really vivid image of it. She has terrible depression, can't experience happiness, and she's awake, and you see her, how she's responding to things, and then they put the electrode in, and I don't know what area or brain region it was, but she experiences happiness, and it is the most, I was just crying, because in the video, she just starts crying, and she's like, I can't believe I feel this way, I can't believe I feel this way. And then they stop it and it goes off again. And I just remember it changed the way, it just had such a profound impact on me, the way I saw depression, the way I saw the brain. And yeah, just people are in these situations that are so beyond their control to feel happiness. And then what a privilege is to be someone who can experience it. And it was, and yeah, I wish I could get the video, and maybe some of you who've done undergrad neuro have seen it as well. But yeah, I remember it probably had an impact on my career, to be honest.
That sounds like I would cry too.
Have you seen the video?
I haven't seen that, but I've seen similar ones that are not deep brain stimulation, but that are on like babies who are deaf here for the first time.
Is it similar like that?
Yeah.
Except experiencing happiness.
Happiness. I don't know, because Beth, I know that you are like a soul person.
Yeah.
And I think there's probably something missing between the physical and our minds in some way. Obviously, like the consciousness questions and stuff. But I don't know. That stuff seems pretty strong link between your experience and just the wiring of your brain, which seems.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like when you watch those things, it does feel like, oh.
Or just a bunch of cells.
I can't think about it.
Really? Is it freaking you out?
Doesn't freak me out. I just feel like if I start speaking about it, I'll sound... I guess I still feel that there's room for a soul, even watching that.
Yeah, I think there's lots of ways to explain it. But yeah. I don't know. It's seeing that live and the profound impact that it has on the person's experience. There's not much else that can do that. That's so physical.
Yeah, I don't know. But I suppose when asking Sarab, does this mean that people who have anti-treatment resistant depression, it's just the neurological level, there's nothing else going on? And every researcher we have on, they're like, no, it's still so many things and we don't know. It's still all these other factors that we don't know and there's no one answer. So I guess watching those videos, it feels, wait, we can just do this one thing and it will fix everyone. And Swarup's like, no.
But I think even the fact that it can fix one person is like shocking. And I've never seen the depression application, but did you take the cognitive neuroscience class in Amsterdam? The one where we talked about DBS the entire time? And like Parkinson's? Do you remember that?
I didn't take that.
I feel like that was the main exposure I'd had to it. And I think we watched also some videos of people getting the DBS turned on and then their tremors disappearing.
Yeah.
Which, for some reason, that feels less shocking than the emotional part. But one of the things that was super interesting that they were doing in the Netherlands was that they were trying to figure out exactly what part of the subthalamic nucleus to do the brain stimulation on, because I don't know if research has evolved in the last 4 years, but from what I understood, there was this tiny little structure in the center of the brain. You really have to dig deep to get to it, this subthalamic nucleus. But there's parts of it that are really related to emotional processing, and then there's a part that's motor. And then at the beginning, when they were doing these surgeries, there were all these people who were getting it implanted in the wrong place, and then they lost their houses because they gambled or they ruined their relationships. Yeah, their Parkinson's was being treated because they targeted the wrong area. It completely changed their personalities because when the machine was turned on, it completely just altered the way they were processing emotion. And sometimes it wouldn't happen immediately, but it would happen over the course of a couple weeks. They just didn't know, because they realized that for some people it worked. But then for other people, and the structure is so tiny. And I think even there were points where it would still stop the tremor, but it could still also be inserted into the part that was more emotion related. And then it would just cause these complete 180s in people's personalities. And they would ruin their lives within 2 weeks. Where they would gamble everything, sell their house, lose their house. And then once it stopped, they go back to normal and they're like, oh no, what have I done?
So it would stop. Okay, so I was like, what was the repercussions of this? Did they get their houses back? This just...
I don't know. But when we learned about it, that was like the setup of there's this huge problem, because this works really well in Parkinson's patients to stop the tremors.
Yeah.
But then because we don't understand enough about this tiny structure in the brain, and if you go too far to one side, then you hit that emotional part. You need to make sure you're hitting that motor part. And that was very scary. And the other thing that I learned about this that I was so shocked by, maybe this is obvious if you're in the medical field, but is that when they're doing this open brain surgery to insert the electrode, I guess, they are awake.
Yeah.
Because they need to check that they're like able to do the things they want to do. People will go in with their violins and stuff to make sure that they can still play so they're not messing up anything.
I remember when we were doing gene therapy at my lab at Cornell, and it's not an electrode, but because we were putting an injection into the brain, I remember thinking, how can we literally drill a hole in the skull and insert an injection into the brain and it come out and everything be fine?
It's on non-humans.
But I just remember thinking, I felt confused by the... Because on some level, the brain seems so fragile and little things can make massive changes. And that's why things like TMS work and this kind of stuff. But then on the other hand, you can do things like insert an injection or electrode through the brain and everything be all right. And I've always found it hard to understand both. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that's also... like the feeling of, oh, wow, this is so amazing that this deep brain stimulation leads someone who's never experienced happiness to be happy for the first time. But then if you're getting concussed all the time, nothing seems to be happening. Or they used to do those epilepsy surgeries where they're just fully cut the connection in the center of the brain. And mostly people seem fine. That seems like something you shouldn't be able to do.
Yeah.
But to me, I think to me, it makes me feel like, obviously I'm the materialist out of the two of us, but it makes me feel like there's just something that we don't understand. I mean, clearly there's a lot we don't understand about the matter, but if we were to be able to fully understand the matter, then we would be able to fully understand the mind, because we get so close sometimes.
Mind matter.
Whoa, is that actually just like me versus you?
Yeah, minds I minds your matter.
Whoa, that's crazy.
That is crazy. I don't know, I feel like it's too complex and there's too many different levels, and I guess these things, rather than making me feel like I have more answers, I just have more questions.
I think that's true, but I think that it's building to something, I feel like, that we could fully understand, but I feel like you're not convinced by that.
No, I'm not convinced.
The other thing I wanted to ask you was, at some point you talked about this link between the cingulate and the insula, and how the link between cingulate to insula, and then Sarab was talking about how that loop might be overactive when people have anxiety, like at a certain point of the loop. Do you feel like that is an intervention target that you feel like could help you?
Help me specifically?
Yeah.
Yeah, it gets hard, doesn't it? Because it's funny also with the anxiety intervention, whether I would want all my anxiety to go away, I don't know. And it's interesting also when I speak about my optimism work, I get a lot of people, particularly artists, who are like, I don't know if I would want all of my, and it's like different levels of depression, but they're like, I don't know if I would want all my depression to go away. So I don't know if there's ways these interventions can, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's tough. And yeah, Melissa Beck was one of our very first interviews, does this work on loneliness, and loneliness is very related to depression. And she finds in a lot of this research on loneliness that lonely people are more atypical to everyone. So they basically are like processing information in ways that are different, not just to central people in the network, but also to other lonely people. And those people probably do turn out to be like artists and have good ideas. Yeah. And this goes to a lot of the things we've been talking about lately too, with AI and everyone normalizing and just becoming really similar, and what we lose in the pursuit of comfort.
Yeah. But
I think that seems like an individual choice. I don't think you can tell someone, oh, you need to get this because you'll be happier. But also if everyone wanted to be happy at the expense of maybe some more interesting ideas, I feel like we can't really say no.
And I suppose it's the level of suffering too. The level of suffering you have, it's going to be different for everyone. And for some people, it will be, I can deal with this amount of suffering and it's important to my work, and other people, it will be like, no, this is just too much and I need this to stop.
I feel like it's also probably what you feel like it brings you and what you actually do with it. Because if it's artists who are like, I don't want to be optimistic.
I get that a lot though, people saying that.
Yeah. But that's probably because they feel like something central to their identity, and also probably a lot of like material things, like their careers, are tied to this thing that maybe makes them suffer but gives them other things.
Yeah.
Because I feel like there are probably a lot of people who suffer a lot from poor mental health, but who feel really attached to it as an identity.
And it was very interesting because different psychiatric disorders have different ways of becoming someone's identity. And one of the reasons eating disorders are so hard to treat is because it's so much a part of that person's identity. Treating the disorder, they feel like they're treating, they don't want to give it up because it's a part of who they are. Different disorders have that, this is a part of who I am. And that can make it harder to treat because you're like, I don't want to give that up. I think that's it. Yeah, it just comes back to how complicated everything is.
Yeah, humans are so complicated.
Yeah, humans are very complicated.
Okay, you win this round, Beth.
Do you just want to let us know what you're excited about, what's coming up next?
There's so many multiple projects that keep on happening and you're excited about them. This is the macro scale integration and segregation of the brain properties. Again, in movies, by the way. Because yep. Those movies are, again, very like fantastic for tapping into these things. So the idea is just some of the basic nuclei apparently control these integrated states and segregation states of the brain. When I say integration, it's pretty much like the whole brain completely connected to each other and working together. The segregation states would be somewhere there would be modules in the brain which are working, but they're separated from each other. The idea is there's some nuclei which control this integration, segregation states. People, we don't have direct evidence for these kind of things. The intracranial EEG, I have in my PhD collected this data where people have this intracranial EEG electrodes and they have made them watch a movie, a 20-minute movie. So then I can tap into this moment-by-moment basis of 5 seconds windows and see what was the integration, what was the segregation, and how it links to heart rate, which is a sympathovagal balance, which is controlled by like adrenal movement and cholinergic, which are supposed to be the neurotransmitters in those nuclei, which control the integration and segregation states. So yeah, I've done more analysis. I'm excited about this. And just finishing that up, other bits of research is with DBS studies in the bed nucleus of stria terminalis is another target for deep brain stimulation in psychiatric illnesses. So we tend to use, I have moving data in there. I haven't analyzed it yet, but this one is just a traditional task paradigm of just showing them pictures, static pictures of emotion, and just quantify some differences if that relates to the depression ratings, anxiety ratings. So that's another kind of research. So at least in the near future, that's the one. I will not say I'm particularly excited about writing grants. That's what I have to do as well. If I want to continue to work on this brain-body framework and emotions and affecting ourselves.
Thank you to Dr. Sarab Sankhasare for joining us this episode. Our intro and outro music is Nobody Stayed for the DJ by Glacio. Our transition music is Back for More, also by Glacio. Minds Matter is mixed, edited, and created by Beth Fisher, she's the Australian one, and me, Ava Madasouza. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode, but in the meantime, find all our episodes and show notes on mindsmatterpodcast.com.